Hello, cricket nuts, and welcome to issue 4 of Andy Zaltzman's World Cricket Podcast, the planet's leading cricket podcast that is recorded by a lapsed Jew in his living room in South London.
Andy Zaltzman's World Cricket Podcast.
I am Andy Zaltzman, author of the confectionery stall blog on Crick Info, and I once cried when I was run out backing up. I'm not afraid to tell you that, the bowler fingertipped a straight drive onto the stumps. I was out of my crease like a good young batsman should be, and I wept salty tears of despair as I trudged back into the pavilion. I was only 10, but it still keeps me awake at night, haunted by failure and injustice. Still, it's only a game. Curse you, cruel fate. And I was batting like a dream that day, albeit a dream that wasn't very good at batting. Still, I was definitely on for double figures, but that's history now. Right, on with the show. Now, I have previously promised you a guest on this podcast, and once again, I cannot fulfil that promise. Because I've not got one guest, I've got two guests! Alex Bowden, author of the excellent King Cricket blog, and Australian comedian Justin Hamilton. More from them later. So, it has been a busy week in cricket land. England very unluckily lost out in the fourth and final test, being narrowly obliterated by an innings and lots of runs by a rampant South Africa. But, have to look at it this way, if England had batted infinitely better and bowled as well as South Africa did, well, the result could have been very different. So many ifs and buts in cricket. You know, if Hashim Amla hadn't pulled off that incredible first ball of the match catch, if Jonathan Trott hadn't batted as if he'd left the oven on in his flat and wanted to get back to check that everything was okay, if Kevin Peterson wasn't more off the boil than a penguin's ice cream, if Matt Prior didn't keep going for the hook like a gluttonous but suicidal fish, if Dale Steyn had stayed injured instead of unfairly recovering, if Mornay Morkel hadn't transformed from a toothless newt into a ravenous fire-breathing dinosaur, and if Fred Truman and Jack Hobbs were both still fit to play, well, who knows how that test match would have gone. And if Daryl Harper, watching the replay of Graham Smith's edge behind early in the kind of match-turning 100 that he is irritatingly prone to playing against England, if Harper hadn't been playing the electric guitar and shouting the laws of cricket to himself or whatever he was doing, and had therefore heard that edge, well, it's hard to see how South Africa would have recovered from that. Because England already had those crucial 180 first innings runs safely in the bank. They'd have had the hosts 36 for 1. Prince was out in the next over, that's 36 for 2. Callis wouldn't have had time to put his pads on, 36 for 3. De Villiers would have come into bat thinking the pitch was a minefield, 36 for 4. Then Dumini would have been next in, 36 for 5. Next over, Amla would have been distracted trying to remember the name of the batsman now at the other end, 36 for 6. Then there would have been a leg bye, 37 for 6. Then Strauss would have put Peterson on and told him to mop up the tail. Peterson, proving that he is still the promising off-spinner South Africa let slip through their fingers all those years ago, would have tweaked out McLaren, Parnell and Morkel, 37 for 9. And then Steyn and Boucher would have both retired hurt after running into each other, trying to get to the non-striker's end to avoid having to face Ryan Sidebottom. 37 all out. So it all came down to two things. One, Daryl Harper's head. And two, the worldwide shortage of hotspot cameras. To be fair, the ICC are trying to breed new hotspot cameras in captivity, but it's just not the mating season for hotspot at the moment, so they're not really up for it. Anyway, all in all, South Africa will still be waking up in the dead of night shouting, "Oh my God, I've just had a terrible nightmare! We only drew with England despite outplaying them in 3 of the 4 tests! I must stop eating cheese before bedtime! What do you mean it actually happened? 4 of their top 7 averaged under 30 and all of their bowlers averaged over 30 and we didn't win? I must stop eating cheese before the start of a test series." And there you go, that's the second Southern Hemisphere accent I've done in the last 2 shows. So, look out, Argentina. England reacted to their Johannesburg drubbing by sacking their captain. Their captain sacked himself, temporarily, for the tour of Bangladesh. And that little we're-taking-this-really-seriously card plopped onto Bangladesh's doorstep just as they were bowling the world's number one ranked side out for 240 in Chittagong. Nice timing, England. Still, they've beaten Australia and drawn away in South Africa, all whilst averaging 7 runs per wicket less than their opponents, with a top batting average, Strauss, of just a fraction over 40, and a best bowling average, Broad, of 31. In this age of excess, we can only applaud England for their hyper-efficient maximisation of resources. And for having Graham Swann in the team, about whom there will be a highly flattering statistic in my next confectionery stall blog.
How's that? That's how.
Well, I'm joined to discuss all this by Alex Bowden, a writer of the legendary King Cricket blog. Hello, Alex.
Hello, Andy.
Thanks very much for coming on the World Cricket Podcast that goes across the entire world of cricket. which is bigger than the real world itself. Now, I read your blog today, and you had some fairly forthright views on the ascendancy of Alistair Cook to the England captaincy.
Yes. Never pass up the opportunity to start a class war, is my motto. My reservations are largely that I can't really see any reason why he's England captain. So I feel a little bit of a stumbling block there.
Right. I guess, you know, he's about the only one left born in England in the top order, other than Collingwood.
Yeah, I mean, I guess everyone else has had a go. And as you say, you're not allowed to pick bowlers to be captain. That's kind of against the international cricket laws.
So you don't see Cook as a Mike Brearley in the making?
No, from what I've seen of him, I mean, all the talk of his attributes is very much what he does behind the scenes. Where we actually get to see him on TV and the newspapers, he's usually a little bit nervous, hasn't got a lot to say. And the one time when he captained England, it was, I think a catastrophe would be a fair
A total catastrophe.
He didn't even think to put a fielder beyond the boundary on the little grass mound there, which was definitely a catching position.
Right. Well, yeah, I mean, that's inexperienced telling there. I mean, a more experienced captain.
He was a schoolboy era.
Yeah.
Although he is only 9. So.
Well, that's another. He doesn't look old enough to be a. He doesn't look like he can grow a beard. And on any cricket captain should have the option of having a beard.
Yeah, you've got to have the face of a captain. Mohammad Yusuf is. Been given the role for Pakistan, excellent beard.
Yep.
A good qualification for the job, no matter what he does out on the field, if there's a beard you can get behind.
Actually, Vaughan, I'm not sure if Vaughan could manage much of a beard.
He may not have had an actual beard, but he gave the air of having a beard.
Yeah, maybe a moustache. You can picture Vaughan with a kind of Victorian, just twiddling a moustache in the gully if he'd been born 100 years earlier.
Waxing the tips to a fine point.
Now, do you think it's rude of England for the captain to have basically dropped himself for a tour of Bangladesh?
Yeah, I do. Kind of think that it looks like England are assuming they're going to win, no matter what they say, and they will say that, oh, it's going to be a tough tour, and we're treating the opposition with all due respect. When you don't send your captain to play, it's not a huge sign of respect, you'd say.
I guess it's like, you know, not sending the real bride to a wedding.
Yeah, I understand it. I shall do.
It was a curious series, as England series tend to be, a mixture of good and bad. You mentioned in your blog as well, England need to take some negatives from the series.
And yeah.
What in particular are you hoping that they take away from on a negative point of view?
Well, I mean, there's a great many things to choose from. I don't feel I should narrow them down to one or two negatives. Because that tends to be the way when taking positives, you'll try and identify just a very, very small number. But with negatives, there's so many to clutch at. Particularly at the top order batting, which is increasingly wobbly. I'm a big fan of that. A negative that's a positive is Alistair Cook's new technique of just only playing the ball into one side, which I'm an immense fan of. I love boring cricket. And he's added a whole... He's removed a whole new dimension to his game.
Well, it seemed to work quite effectively for him. Maybe Peterson should just cut out the leg side and become an offside grinder.
I would recommend it for all the batsmen and... try and drive away some of the fair weather fans who are coming in search of boundaries and wickets and excitement.
Yeah.
And just, you know, leave the game to us.
Yeah, I think there's a lot to be said for that. I mean, had I had the talent to be an international cricketer, based on where I hit the ball as a low-grade village cricketer, I didn't just cut out the leg side, I cut out in front of square on the offside as well. I pretty much scored not in a very narrow V between first slip and fine gully.
That's not VB, that's AV.
Yeah, AV.
A very sharp angle V.
It's interesting talking about the England's wobbly batting. Strauss, who sort of exudes consistency as a man, has been wildly inconsistent. He's averaged over 50 or under 30 in his last 7 series. There's a stat.
Nice stat. I commend you on that stat.
I love stats. I live for stats. Do you think the problems came from him? He was a bit unlucky in this series, I thought.
I don't know. I mean, there was a point in the middle of the series where he'd faced about 9 balls from Morney Morkel and been out 3 times or something. That's not an actual stat. That's one I've basically made up. But it is close to the truth.
Yeah.
It was a small number of balls and a large number of wickets. It was a great wicket to ball ratio, which is not really what you want from a batsman.
No.
So he was consistent around the middle of the series. He was consistently walking to and from the wicket.
And England's bowling, as it was in the Ashes, they had a couple of great spells, and around that didn't look that threatening. How do you see them doing in Bangladesh?
Well, I'm hoping they'll stick to the same tactics of being pretty underwhelming the majority of the time and basically mugging the opposition in a very, very small window of 5 or 6 overs in one of the test matches, because that's definitely the way forward.
Classic ambush tactics.
Yeah, basically. They basically put on masks, hide away and leap out at the opportune moment.
And finally, Ian Bell had a mixed series, two very good games, two less good. Do you think he's finally cracked it, or partially cracked it, or is he going to carry on the pattern that he's had for his career so far?
Traditionally, I've always had very strong feelings about Ian Bell. And I would
romantically?
No. My strong feeling is that I am largely without opinion about him. You have a strong opinion about not having an opinion? I've always stuck to that, no matter what he's done. If he's scored 199, I've kept level and not gone overboard. And if he's been out for a duck, I've not berated him for it. I'm largely underwhelmed by him, whatever he does.
Right. Well, that, I guess that's the kind of following Rudyard Kipling's advice of treating Ian Bell's triumphs and disasters the same.
Specifically Ian Bell, because Rudyard Kipling was speaking about Bell, I believe.
He was a big Ian Bell
fan many years before he was born.
Great. Well, thanks very much, Alex Bowden. Hopefully we'll be talking to you again on the show, if anyone's listening to it, around the world of cricket that it's being broadcast to. You can catch Alex's blog at kingcricket.co.uk. Bye.
Bye.
You can't score ones in the filly.
Aside from Test cricket, the IPL auction took place this week. The bizarre annual ritual in which some of the world's leading cricketers are led into an auction hall like farm animals, are groped and prodded by IPL team owners and Bollywood superstars, have their teeth and hooves checked before being bid on. Well, I didn't actually see it, but I like to think that is what happens. All I do know is that the Deccan Chargers have bought Ian Botham and are going to put him out to stud in an effort to breed the perfect all-rounder. And once again in the auction, I was left on the shelf. I can't believe it. I know I'm not the most valuable 2020 player in the world. In fact, I'm only just the most valuable 2020 player in my household. My little son, now aged 1.09, has got a decent throwing arm. Although batting, he does still remain vulnerable to the fast end swinging Yorker, as I ruthlessly exploit in our thrice daily games of indoor cricket. Ruthlessly, with my bowling machine. The main feature of the IPL auction was the total, and it seemed deliberate and coordinated, refusal to pick any Pakistan player. Well, why would these teams want anyone who was in the world champion team? And when you can get the largely unproven Kieran Pollard for a knockdown $750,000, why would you even think of World 2020 semi-final and final man of the match and proven devastator with bat and ball, Shahid Afridi?
It's cricket time!
On to Australia now, and if Pakistan followers could have easily predicted the second test meltdown from a position of seeming impregnability, they would also certainly have predicted that they would then get horsewhipped in the final test, as indeed they did. They helped the somewhat workmanlike Australians on their way by dropping Ricky Ponting on naught, costing them a cheeky double 100 to the baggy green skipper, and then losing their two best batsmen to runouts. Classic. And a quick word for Danish Kaneria, who in Hobart conceded 150 runs in an innings for his third test in a row, the 7th time in his last 9 tests and the 12th time in his career. This puts him second equal with Kumble and 2 behind Murali in the list of bowlers who've conceded 150 in most test innings. Kaneria has reached 12 in just 58 tests. Kumble and Murali have each played 132. Danish Kaneria truly is the Don Bradman of conceding 150 runs in test innings. Although, to be fair to him, hang on, this is turning into a statistic.
Splat! It's a Zot stat!
Of the 11 bowlers who have conceded 150 runs 4 or more times in tests, only counting those innings in which they've conceded 150, Kaneria has the best average, 45. That's not so bad, better than Murali's 50, Kumble's 55, or Vinu Mankad's frankly embarrassing 64. So cut the guy some slack next time you bump into him. And there's a link to that statistic in the transcript of this podcast, so you can treasure it like a long-lost dog.
That's a top banana.
Now to look back at the Australian season, I spoke to my fellow comedian, all the way from Melbourne, the city where Test cricket began, Justin Hamilton, whose words you might have heard in the last podcast, read by me, well, here he is now, in the flesh. Well, the audio flesh, at least. Justin Hamilton, welcome to the World Cricket Podcast.
Hello!
So, Australia have now finished their test summer. How do you personally, as an Australian cricket fan, think it's gone?
You know, it's been exciting because it's given me a new love of the West Indies and a first love of Pakistan. You know, they had lots of young guys that were exciting. One of the bowlers wasn't afraid to blow a kiss at Shane Watson when he bounced him a couple of times. And you really went, wow, I really like this young team. And then Chris Gayle came out and went, hang on a sec, not only am I really cool, I'll blast a couple of centuries and then bow to my teammates. And you went, wow, the West Indies are pretty cool again. And then after a while you went, oh, Australia won.
So that was sort of bottom of the list, winning five tests out of six.
I know a lot of people that would have been quite happy to see Pakistan take that Sydney test. And I think quite a few people would have been happy to see the West Indies win in Perth. So I think Australia still wanted to win the series, but I think the other teams showed a bit more spunk. And you know what the Australian team's like. It really has no sense of humour. So I think that sticks in the core a little bit.
So who have been the stars of this new team as it emerges from the wreckage of the Ashes, which I assume, as a nation, you still haven't quite come to terms with losing those Ashes. I hope so.
We've struggled a little bit. Ricky Ponting is pretty certain that everything's fine now. He's claimed that this summer all the boxes have been ticked for redemption, winning the Champions League trophy, the series wins against Pakistan and the West Indies. It's always good to take out the 6th and 8th ranked teams in the world to remind yourself that you are the best. And the Golden Globe Award for a technical category, best editing by a sports team. That was a surprise, but right. you know, it was also a victory. So.
A trophy's a trophy. Yeah, that's what Australia's all about as a nation. Yeah,
exactly. We don't care what it is, as long as we can put it on the mantelpiece.
You see this lack of sense of humour in your national side. Do you think you're sort of missing Shane Warne, particularly in that regard?
Without a doubt. You know, like saying this Australian team lacks a sense of humour is a bit like saying Tom Cruise is too short to be a real man. It's you're watching it and jokes have been missed all the way through the game. You know, like when Mohammad Asif has appealed for wickets, not one Aussie player has retorted, as if. Oh, that would be hilarious, right? Not that the joke is that funny, but that actually someone thought of a joke on the team. You know, that's what's killing me. No one's even thinking of these things. I haven't seen one player giggle in his baggy green cap when Butt has sauntered down the pitch to lift one ball high. What is wrong with these players? Because we used to have that schoolboy humour, and that's what we're known for and love. Like, now no one even pretends to gag when they read the headline, Siddle to fire up in dead rubber. You know, I have a fear that if there was a player on the opposition called Goosey Flog Your Log a Lot, these players would look at that name and be more concerned about spelling it than getting in a good sledge.
So, I mean, it's the sledging, because it was pretty unimpressive during the Ashes, the standard of Australian sledging. Has that shown no real signs of picking back up?
I don't think it has. I think it's more whiny. You know, before where it used to be, you know, having a bit of a crack, now you kind of look at the players and they're all just standing around going, oh, don't do that. Why are you doing that? Don't be rude to Watson.
For England, most of the sledging has been at the technology and at Daryl Harper. The technology is the victim. We've taken the humanity out of sledging. So Mitchell Johnson was one of the big disappointments of the Ashes last summer, but how has he found his redemption on and off the field? Because he had the big problem with his girlfriend and his mother going at each other throughout the Ashes.
You know, I'm an Australian. I'm more than happy to admit that in certain places, but I was even shocked that Mitchell Johnson got Cricketer of the Year, especially after the Ashes. Like, you remember he got the award straight after the Ashes and you're going, yeah. Well, you know, you can't. It's not the Oscars. Mitchell also went wicketless for the first time in an innings since Lords.
Right.
In Tasmania. He has refuted allegations that he thought he saw his mum in the crowd. This was more down to two reasons. Firstly, he said this is the best batting lineup he's ever faced. And their lack of runs is just one of those statistical anomalies. And secondly, he had pulled some muscles in his stomach that were caused by severe convulsions that were brought on by accidentally seeing Peter Siddle coming out of the team shower. If it had been that dishy Michael Clarke or Shane Watson, that would have been fine. But you're taking your life into your own hands when you see Siddle or new boy Bollinger in the nude.
I'll have to take your word for that, Justin. We're luckily immune from that on the other side of the world. So what was the theory in Australia for why there was it 21 consecutive half-centuries without a century? My personal theory was that having lost the Ashes despite outscoring England by 8 centuries to 2, they were deliberately avoiding scoring centuries in order to win.
It's like how Ponting refuses to bowl first ever since the Ashes of 2005. You know, the other theories is that I just don't reckon the team's anywhere near as good as it has been in the past. And I put it down to, I think there's 37 people playing cricket in Australia.
Right, I see.
All up. Yes. Cricket is now lagging, this is true, is lagging behind in popularity in Australia, behind Australian rules football, swimming, horse racing, motor racing, soccer, or as you call it correctly, football, netball, mixed netball, men's netball, golf frisbee, and racially vilifying taxi drivers. I think cricket is just above basketball and tennis. And if Leighton Hewitt beats Andy Murray this week, I'm sure that will rocket to number 8 on the hit parade. But
why has that happened? Because, I mean, cricket clearly is the greatest game in the world. So what is wrong with your country?
I don't know. You know, I blame Shane Warne. I blame Shane Warne because I think he came along and he was a larrikin off the field. He was a beautiful player to watch. He got results. And then I think we had a whole generation of kids coming through thinking, I want to be Shane Warne. And it turns out there's only one Warne, much to the disappointment of phone suppliers all over the world. But the thing is that I think the disappointment set in and everyone's just going, well, I can't be Warne. There's no point going on.
So there isn't a generation of new young Australians thinking, I want to be Nathan Horitz.
I don't think that's happening at all.
Does Nathan Horitz want to be Nathan Horitz? That's the big question.
You know what Nathan Horitz is going to be. Ponting reckons that Horitz is now the answer for the lingering question asked by the departures of Warne and McGill. But, of course, that question is, who will not be making us forget about Shane Warne and Stuart McGill? Of course, the three answers I'd accept there are Horitz, that dude over there in the white, and no thanks, I just ate a bagel.
Well, Horitz, he's done pretty well, though, hasn't he? I mean, his test stats are way ahead of his Sheffield Shield, or whatever you call it now, stats.
Yeah, I think he was equal wicket taker with Mitchell Johnson with 29 for the summer, which is pretty good. But, you know, he still copped it from everybody. Pakistan's captain, Muhammad Yusuf, said the most disappointing aspect of the tour was giving Horitz so many wickets that his figures flatter him. But, you know, what few people realise is that some of Pakistan's batting meltdowns were so tragic, they actually managed to give two of their wickets to Richie Benaud. So that's amazing figures for a man who didn't bowl.
Yeah. So another guy who has come back slightly is Mike Hussey, Mr. Cricket for a while. Oh. Early this year, did look like cricket had divorced him, but they seem to have patched things up.
Cricket had been off having an affair on Mr. Cricket, I think.
Great. Well, thanks very much, Justin. Thanks for coming on the show. Well, actually, just as a way of introducing ourselves to the listeners of the World Cricket Podcast, if indeed there are any, you just maybe tell us your favourite player from your childhood when you first got into cricket. Who was your personal hero?
My personal hero, it was the 80s, so therefore you know it can't be an Australian player. It was Viv Richards.
Right.
Viv Richards was the all-time hero of mine, and I got to see him play once, and he got out for a third ball duck in a one-day match. And I was quite young, and after the match, I hung around to get his autograph, and I ran up, and my mum was pretty scared because as I started running up, there were a whole lot of Aussies on one side yelling out, quack, quack, as Viv Richards walked out. And I went up and asked for his autograph, and he not only signed it, he put his arm around me and apologised for playing so poorly, brought me over to his son and said, you have a very charming son. And the love affair with Viv Richards has never abated, and I feel sorry for every cricketer who doesn't live up to that monumental man.
What a hero. Great. Well, thanks a lot, Justin, and hopefully we'll talk to you again soon.
Excellent. Thank you.
Thanks again to Justin, whose website address is justinhamilton.com.au. And all hail to Viv Richards, although his test batting average is less than Thilan Samarawira's, which goes to show that there are lies, damned lies, and statistics, and 21st century batting averages. So that's it for this edition of the World Cricket Podcast. Thanks very much for listening, if indeed you have been. And if you haven't been listening and aren't listening, I have absolutely nothing to say to you. Thanks also to Alex Bowden, aka King Cricket, and to Justin Hamilton. And of course, to cricket itself. There'll be more from me on the Confectionery Store blog in the next few days, and I'll be back with another podcast in a couple of weeks' time. In the meantime, I'll play you out with more lies about cricketers. Australian batsman Greg Ritchie thinks it should be illegal to wait at a bus stop for more than 15 minutes. Legendary West Indian paceman Joel Garner used to prepare for test matches by baking gingerbread men in the shape of opposition batsmen, then eating them whilst warming up in the nets. Indian master Dilip Vengsarkar once took a can of tuna fish for a walk along the beach, just because he felt like it. And finally, 1950s South African dasher, now there's a set of words you don't hear very often, Roy McLean, once accidentally ate a ferret after tripping up whilst walking in the woods, falling over and landing face down, mouth open, in a rabbit hole.